The views and comments expressed on the Space Show by its guests, callers, and listeners belong to them. The Space Show and its hosts serve only as a platform and are not responsible for others' comments or views. All topics discussed on the Space Show are primarily for educational purposes.
To go to the moon in this decade and do the other thing.
One small step for man.
Easy,
we have made an engine start. 4, 3, 2, 1.
It's the Space Show with Dr. David Livingston. Broadcasting for 7 continents, consistently bringing you quality news and interviews with the best and brightest minds in the new space economy. Here is the founder and host of the Space Show, the man who best articulates the vision of space commercial enterprise, Dr. David Livingston.
Good afternoon, everyone. Welcome to a special edition of our Friday Space Show program at a special time. I am your host, David Livingston. Thank you for tuning in. Great discussion coming up in a few minutes. Let me run through the announcements so that we can get to the meat of the program. If you are able to give us a call and would like to talk to us on our toll-free line, it is 1-866-687-7223. Remember, there are no call screeners. Let the phone ring and we'll answer it and bring it up on air just as quickly as we possibly can. You can also communicate with us and our guest today through email at drspace@thespaceshow.com, or you can post a comment on our blog. And to do that, go to thespaceshow.com, and all the way over to the far right is the upcoming show menu. And this is the first program listed. That is our archive page for this program. So scroll all the way down, and you can see comments down at the bottom. And as soon as you post your comment or question, I will get a copy of it and integrate your comment or question into our discussion. The toll-free number is our preferred way, 1-866-687-7223. But we definitely do want to hear from you, so thank you for that. While you're at our website, thespaceshow.com, note that our comprehensive website newsletter is center right on the homepage. It is uploaded fresh every Sunday, right after our Space Show program airs on Sunday, or maybe a little while after that. And it has all of the programming for the week in detail. And in addition to that, it has a future events section. So if you scroll down, you'll see all the programs we have planned, and we're booking through first quarter 2018 right now. So do check it out. If you have any questions, don't hesitate to let me know. Everything we do is archived, so you can listen right off of our website or rapidly download the show. There is a Space Show store. You'll find it in the upper left menu under support, and then you look for the Cafe Press Space Show store. So this is where you would buy Space Show logo wear with t-shirts, hats, coffee mugs, things of that nature that say the Space Show on it. And if you have any questions or recommendations, do let us know. We'd like to add to it, and we're happy to accommodate whatever you think might make the store a little bit more attractive. So thank you for that. And then, of course, the most important thing on our website is support the Space Show. So remember, we are a 501c3 nonprofit with one O-N-E, GiantLeapFoundation.org. And we're a listener-financed and driven program, so we do require your support to continue the Space Show. And if you like the programming and you like what we do, then please do support us. So remember, if you pay U.S. federal taxes, you get a tax deduction, as we are a 501c3 nonprofit. And then if you are paying California taxes at the state level, you also get a deduction. We're a California public benefit corporation. So do visit our homepage for our parent company, onegiantleapfoundation.org, or email me if you have any questions. And again, we thank you very much for your support, and let us know if you have questions or can share something with us that might make it easier to get support from Space Show listeners. In addition to the individual programs, we do have sponsorships. And so the sponsorships put your banner ad going across the homepage, And you can change that banner ad pretty much as you like during the year. And I read a 60-second or less spot promoting your business on every Sunday show. So, excuse me, on every show, not just every Sunday show. I apologize for that slip up. And if the show is a shorter show, like a 60-minute length show, I thank the sponsors by name, but I don't read the messages as I don't want to dig into talk time. So if you're interested in having your message read on air on Space Show programs, and by the way, you can change that pretty much as frequently as you would like as well. If you're interested in that kind of a feature and you want your banner ad promoting or saying whatever is applicable to you or your business or your interests, let us hear from you. We do have a couple of sponsorships left. We don't do too many because, as I said, when I read the 60-minute notes, I don't want to dig into talk time that much for the listeners. So the more sponsorships I have with 60-second spots, the less talk time the guest has. So we do try to hold it down to a minimum. But we do have a couple of spots left for 2018. So if you're interested, give me an email, drspace@thespaceshow.com. Excuse me, our sponsors for the first segment of today's program are the Space Foundation. They do have their 34th symposium coming up. And this is the 2018 must-attend space industry event. It's April 16th through the 19th in Colorado Springs, Colorado, at the Broadmoor Hotel, which is world famous. Their website is spacesymposium.org, and this event has amazing contacts, networking available, all sorts of things that you can do to become available. So do check it out, okay? And you know, let us hear from you, and we do hope that we do hear from you. So for today's guest, I am happy to bring back to the program David, hopefully I get it right, Sivaleya. Did I do that right, David?
Almost. Sivalella.
Sivalella. Okay. David really likes the space shuttle. We're going to talk to him about that. So his first book was amazing. We talked about that with Dr. Juritz. His second book is also amazing and detailed and is very, very thorough. The Space Shuttle Program, Technologies and Accomplishments. It's published by Springer Praxis. I have a copy in my hands. I really recommend it. Lots of diagrams, pictures, color pictures, and information in it to help you really understand what the space shuttle could do. Now, in his concluding comments, I'll go ahead and give you a little bit of a spoiler alert here. He does not think the space shuttle was a failure, and we'll ask him why, but he thinks it was a successful vehicle and will be long-lasting in history for all that it's done for a long, long time to come. And we'll probably explore that a little bit with him. David, welcome back to the show, and why the fascination with the space shuttle? I mean, the program's ended, 8 years ago, something like that. They're in the museums. They're never going to fly again. A new hardware is being made that's supposed to be modern, update, sophisticated, landing like the Apollo capsules landed. So why the fascination with the space shuttle?
Hello, David. First and foremost, thanks for having me back on the show, and good afternoon to all your listeners. So, I've always been interested in aviation and spaceflight, always, since I can remember. Also, I was born in 1981, just 3 months after Columbia maiden flight. So, basically, for all my life, I lived through the space shuttle program. I'm not a child of the Apollo program, but I'm a child of the space shuttle program. And as I said before, through all my life, since when I was very, very young, I've always been interested in aviation, aircraft, spacecraft. Probably I was a very unusual kid because I never was interested in cars or bikes or this sort of stuff. So, and I always had a quite inquisitive mind. I always wanted to become an engineer because I like to know how things work. For the space shuttle, I wanted to know how it worked, because it's basically a spacecraft, but also an airplane, over the, because it has wings when it flies back into the atmosphere in order to reach the runway. So, as I was growing up, this was in Italy, I tried to gather as many details, pieces of information, magazines that could, you know, give me a technical overview of the space shuttle. Now, Italian literature on the subject was, and probably still is, very, very scarce. So after a while, I kind of found out everything that I could in English, sorry, in Italian. The problem is I didn't know English at the time. It was only when I went into university in my 20s, early 20s, that I started to learn English, and I also got myself a broadband connection, internet connection, and this allowed me to discover a website like the NASA Technical Report Server, where I found really a goldmine of documents related to the space shuttle. So knowing English, having also getting engineering, formal education, I was able to learn really a lot, and I was really and thrilled to know more about the space shuttle. And since I like reading a lot, in my teenage years, I used to say to myself, I would like to write a book one day. And so I said to myself, well, now I know much more about the space shuttle. I know English. I got myself an engineering education. So why not write a book on the space shuttle where I can describe all the nuts and bolts about the shuttle? Because there was really nothing that was like I wanted, a book that would go in such depth analyzing how the space shuttle worked. So after a few years, I moved to Scotland in the UK, and I met a few authors that write for Springer and Praxis. They gave me a lot of suggestions, advices, and with this, I contacted Springer and Praxis with this project of mine of writing a book on the space shuttle, and they accepted it. And this basically led to my first book, To Orbit and Back Again, How the Space Shuttle Flew in Space. And then I wrote this follow-up, because the first book is on the space shuttle considered as machine. So it's specifically on the orbiter, on the external tank, on the solid rocket boosters, on the procedures for flying space. This second book I wrote now is instead about the technology that flew on the space shuttle. So it's more oriented on the payloads that were flown on the space shuttle. And I just think it's an incredible machine. You know, there's nothing like this. Such a unique and iconic piece of aerospace engineering that really deserves to be understood and exposed to the public.
First of all, a note to the listeners, we had a little audio issue earlier in what David was saying, and I've made some adjustments. You may have heard me fooling around or some strange sounds. I think we're through, and I apologize for those audio issues, but I think I got them resolved, so I did want to put that out there. Finding all of this technical information, I mean, it's a huge research job, but you also have to be able to understand it and know how it was put together and what every little piece of it did. I mean, there, you don't put it together and say, whoops, I got a couple of parts remaining here. I mean, that just, that doesn't cut it. So how did you figure out or get a tutorial or learn all about what all these parts and the technology and the design did for the shuttle?
Since I've always been interested in the subject through the years, I kind of learned how a spacecraft, you know, generally speaking, how a spacecraft flies in space, what are the main onboard systems that you need for a spacecraft, especially if there are astronauts on board that are necessary for properly for proper function, like, I don't know, propulsion system, reaction control systems, thermal protection system, and so on. And then, you know, you gather a lot of documents, and then you start to categorizing them. So you find documents about the engines, documents about the structure, documents about the electric system. And so in this way, at least this is how I did it, I build up the layout for my book. And this is the approach that I always followed. You do a lot of research, and you kind of find a pattern or layout, I don't know how you want to call it. And based on that, then you start creating also the layout for your own book and how you want to present the different topics and how you want to connect it to each other so that your book can also read not only as a manual, but more like a story, so it's more enjoyable to read.
Do you have a favorite mission or payload that you learned about that flew on the shuttle, and what would it be?
I might be a little bit biased here, but I think one of the best missions they flew were the tethered satellite missions in the 90s, where basically they flew a small satellite off the space shuttle, linked to it by a long tether. Probably you will remember them. They were STS 46 and 75.
Uh-huh.
Very challenging missions because the dynamic of tethered systems is very complex, because they are large systems. In this case, the experiment was meant to have this satellite being deployed up to 20 kilometers from the space shuttle. And when you do that in the gravitational field of Earth, in the magnetic field of the planet, you have all sorts of vibrational modes that are triggered. It's like, you know, when you are playing guitar, you know, depending how you strike the chord, you can produce different sounds. So the same thing is for a tether. It's basically a long chord in tension, and there are all sorts of external forces, aerodynamic drag, electrostatic force, that are all working together or against each other, depends, and they create a lot of instability in the system. So it's very difficult to keep it in place. But they're very fascinating systems because you can, for instance, create you know, very large structures that are also lightweight. In the future, if we ever go to Mars, these spacecraft will need to have, for instance, a rotating section to create an environment of artificial gravity. If we don't want to spin the astronaut like in a centrifuge in the washing machine, the structure, this rotating section will need to have a large diameter so you can slow down the rotation. Now, if you want to do such a large structure and you want it to be also light in weight, you can use TEDF, for instance. But you need to know how these systems work. And those missions were very good at, for the very first time, to understand how these systems could work. Unfortunately, they were not very lucky because on the first mission, the tether got stuck at 256 meters. They couldn't deploy up to the nominal length of 20 kilometers. And on the second mission, they reached 19 kilometers, and then a short circuit basically severed the tether, and the whole thing got lost in space, basically. But despite these two failures, anyway, got very good data on the dynamics of tethered systems, and they also were able to carry out a lot of scientific investigations. And the reason why I said I'm a little bit biased is because this was an Italian experiment. I'm Italian, so it was a very good project devised by an Italian scientist called Giuseppe Colombo, a very well-famous figure in NASA. because he was the one that invented, he came out with the flyby maneuver to approach Venus in the early 60s. And he was also interested in third assistance. What he had in mind, unfortunately, NASA didn't do it, but his original idea was basically to have the shuttle deploying this satellite into the atmosphere, because in this way you could study the upper layers of the atmosphere without going actually inside the atmosphere, because as you know, you need to be at a certain altitude if you don't want the atmospheric drag to drag you down. So you need to be quite high up in order to remain in orbit. And if you want to study the upper layers of the atmosphere up close, you need to be there. And this would have been a very nice way of being basically into the atmosphere, but since the satellite would be dragged by this shuttle, which was at higher altitude, you could study this region of the atmosphere for days and days without worrying about decaying into the atmosphere. So it was a very cool idea. And there were actually plans to also do something like that, but unfortunately, since the experiment failed on the last mission, STS-75, then NASA abandoned every other plan. But I think they were very, very cool missions, probably among the most difficult ones that the shuttle flew.
So Bob has sent you a note from Denver. He's our first emailer of today. And he said, I recall when the shuttle retired, there was lots of controversy. A lot of people thought that the shuttle could continue to fly, and many others thought that for safety reasons, even though it did not have all of its hours that they projected that it would have, they should let it retire. What are your thoughts on that? Should it have retired or kept flying?
I think they should have kept flying it, at least up to when we had a means to reach space that doesn't rely on the Russians. So I think they could have kept flying it maybe two times a year, you know, reduced regime. Because anyway, after the Columbia accident, NASA took a lot of measures to increase safety. And in the last missions, the system was performing really, really well. Was really, really good. So I think they could have kept flying it. In the meantime, NASA could have, or SpaceX could have developed the new generation of spacecraft to reach the space station. At least we would have had the opportunity to keep, at least NASA would have had the opportunity to keep flying hardware and astronauts on their own without relying on the Russians. Because now it's basically, we have a single point failure in the system. If for any reasons, political tensions between the U.S. and Russia, or, I don't know, a catastrophic accidents in Baikonur, we might lose the capability of sending astronauts to the space station or in space. And we are waiting for too long for SpaceX or Boeing to develop their own spacecraft and NASA as well. So I think they could have kept flying it. And then once we knew that we had a replacement, then we could have, phased out the shuttle.
Do you think that the shuttle, if they had kept flying it, or instead of going this capsule route, which everybody seems to be going, could they have, I don't know, for lack of a better word, modernized the shuttle again to make it continue to extend? I mean, we're not going to have anything like the shuttle's capabilities, even with the Dragon or Bezos or CST-100. I think only Dragon even has a downward capability with limited cargo, where the shuttle could bring things back. So it seemed to a lot of us that they could have been designed again or given some redesign or something and continued to fly, because there's just nothing that seems to be approaching the capability of the shuttle?
Okay, a difficult question. The shuttle had the capability of delivering cargo payload and also to fly with astronauts. And the astronauts could perform variety of tasks, such as undertaking spacewalking for repairing Hubble, for instance,
right,
or assembling the space station, or, you know, if there was a space lab module, they could do some research. I think that in the long run, it's better if we separate the function of carrying astronauts into space and back and carrying payloads. In the future, if we have to build other space stations or spacecraft to go on Mars, whatever, I don't think we need to have a spacecraft that also is capable of carrying astronauts. It would be just enough to use the Russian approach. I mean, if you see the way in which the Russians build their own modules for the space station, is basically to have these modules as independent units. They are brought in orbit by an expendable rocket, and then the modules, on their own power, they reach the station and they dock to it. And then you can send on a separate spacecraft the astronauts into to the outpost. So I think it's better if we separate these two functions, because it can be more effective. The initial idea of the space shuttle was not to have only the space shuttle, but was to build up infrastructure in low Earth orbit made of space stations, large infrastructures for manufacturing products, having space tugs moving satellites from higher orbit to lower orbit, where astronauts could carry out, for example, maintenance or servicing. The problem is that we lost all that part, and we only kept the space shuttle because of funding reasons. But if this space shuttle had performed as initially advertised, that to say, as if it was an airliner that could fly every 2 weeks, then probably we could have accepted this way of flying payload and people together. But if we are not able to do that, I think it's better to separate the two functions. Also because, you know, space flight is still risky. And obviously you don't want to risk lives just for sending payloads into orbit. If you separate the two functions, then you're also reducing the risk for the astronauts. And I think it might be more effective. There were plans in the 80s to create an unmanned version of the space shuttle. It was called Shuttle C. It basically was just the payload bay with the engines section in on the back without any wing. And that would have been used to, you know, just ferry modules to the space stations. And then astronauts could reach these places, again, on another space shuttle. But in this way, you are really lowering the risk for human lives. I don't know. Does it make sense?
I was not one who wanted to see it retire. I thought they could have done things with it to make it fly. And I also understand that at the time they were predicting the gap where you would not have human spaceflight with American crews was going to be much shorter than what it has turned out to be.
Yeah.
So
they say, I remember at the beginning, this was when President Bush announced the what was called the Vision for Space Exploration,
right,
VSE.
VSE, uh-huh.
There were plans to basically reuse part of the space shuttle hardware and create something that was similar to the space shuttle C I was talking about before.
Right.
So having basically external tank, the two solid rocket boosters, and then a huge fairing to the side of the external tank, which was basically the payload bay of the shuttle. And in this manner, you could have, you know, had the capability of sending space a lot of payloads in just one go. So I think that was a brilliant idea, I thought. Unfortunately, we didn't go in that direction. And this would have allowed us to retain the capability of huge haulage into space. Maybe SLS might do it, but again, the development time of this project is really appalling. and as far as modifying the shuttle and making it more modern, I don't think there was much more that you could do, to be honest. Maybe they could upgrade the avionics, but as far as the structure was concerned, it was a pretty much frozen design. If you wanted to, again, in the 80s, they also had plans to stretch the shuttle, make it a little bit longer or a little bit shorter. There were also these two options. But the structural changes that you need to go through to do that were really too much. Basically, it was like redesigning the whole thing because you are changing mass properties, the mechanics of the whole structure. So it really becomes difficult. And also, I have to say another thing, which might be a little bit strange to you, to your listeners, but there was a big mistake with the space shuttle, and the mistake was that he had wings. Because you don't need wings to go in space. Those wings are heavy, and they're only needed on the last half an hour of a multi-day mission. They're only there to glide through the atmosphere and reach your runway. We can discuss later why I think that the space shuttle was a success, but the idea of having a space plane is not really a wise one, at least not such a big space plane, because you are bringing with you such a dead weight that you could have used to carry payload. And that's why also, I was saying before, the idea of separating cargo transportation from crew transportation is probably the best approach. You can carry the astronauts with a capsule, and they just go up there, and then you can bring cargo on a different manner. And if you want to bring something back, then maybe you can design an unmanned lifting body that can glide back to Earth.
You have another email question.
Okay.
Carla is in Seattle, and she says, David, have you ever been over to see a shuttle? Did you see any shuttle launches, or have you been inside one or seen them in the museum? I'd be interested in your visuals rather than just your historical and technical writing. What did you think if you actually saw the shuttle firsthand?
So I went so far to the Kennedy Space Center 5 times, and for 2 times I missed the launch, fortunately. One time I even had a VIP pass that was for the last mission of Discovery. Unfortunately, they discovered the hydrogen leak on the external tank, so they had to roll the whole thing back in the VIP. So I saw the space shuttle on the launch pad. I tried to attend to a launch. Unfortunately, I never saw a space shuttle launch. But I saw Atlantis in the at the Kennedy Space Center, in the Atlantis exhibition, and it's absolutely beautiful. I quite like. Have you ever been there, David?
Yes, I've seen a night launch, and I was inside Endeavour when they were taking it apart and readying it for the Los Angeles Museum. That one was really hard to do, but we did go inside of it and got to see how little room there was in it. It was even hard to get into the pilot's chair or the captain's chair.
Yeah.
It's so tight, but it was historic. I'm glad I got to see what it was like inside. You know, it's very tight inside, even though it's on different levels where the crew is. And so first of all, nobody who is at all modest on anything your body does or looks like, nor anybody who's claustrophobic could ever do anything on the shuttle other than peek in and take a tourist quickie view of what it was like. There's no privacy. I mean, even the bathroom really doesn't have privacy. You have a curtain you pull. It is really tight and crowded when you're in your seats, and when you're in your spacesuits, it's even more tight and crowded. And if you have to use the airlock, you know, you're going to go do a spacewalk or this or that or the other, it becomes even more crowded and tight. And the kitchen equipment is everywhere, and the food storage is there. And it's really the amount of space. I mean, you see this whole big thing, and you think, God, that's really big. It's like a 737 or something. No, part for the people is, I don't know, it's smaller than a small studio apartment. It's like maybe a minivan on top of a minivan. You know, a two-deck minivan, maybe.
That might
kind of be a subcompact minivan, in fact. So I'm glad you got to see. Did you get to go in it, or just see it from the outside?
No, I only saw from the outside, and I think they did a wonderful job with the Atlantis exhibition at the KSC, because you know you go inside and there is kind of a spiral,
right,
that goes upward, and there are a few paintings on the walls, and then you get into a room, a large room. They close the doors, and then they start playing a cut down. So you can only hear, you know, the usual conversations between the crew and the flight controllers. And then you go to the moment where the engines ignite. Obviously, you know, you are surrounded by sound. And there's also a little bit of vibration because of the sound. So it's very...
realistic.
There's a lot... Yeah, absolutely. And then all of a sudden they open the doors and you have the Atlantis just facing you. And I found it very, very touching. I was almost crying, seriously. It was really, really moving, because that was, for me, the first time that I was able to see the shuttle up close. After having studied so much and written so much about it, I then finally could see it. And it was really, really beautiful. They did a very good job. You go all around the shuttle so you can see, because it is at an angle, like if it was flying space. The payload bay doors are open, so you can see inside all the mechanisms. You can see several details. And you just walk all around it, and it's very, very good. I would like to come back, to be honest, to it again.
You have an email from Bijan. We haven't heard from you in a while, Bijan. He's over in Sweden. He's sort of your neighbor. Would it have been feasible and beneficial to make the space shuttle autonomous so that it could launch without any crew, or with only two crew if a mission required a spacewalk? I suppose the Air Force then wouldn't need the X-37. Also, how do you compare the STS shuttle with the Soviet Energia Zenit Buran system? Well, of course, the Buran was copied from the shuttle, but and didn't even survive a storm where the ceiling fell on top of it in the hangar, unfortunately. But anyway, go ahead, answer comment on his question.
Actually, the space shuttle had the capability of flying autonomously because you had an autopilot. De facto, the ascent, if everything went well, the ascent and reentry were all automatic. All the computers were doing everything. The two pilots were just there monitoring that everything was going as advertised, as intended. And then in case something went wrong, then they would accomplish some manual change. You know, they might have changed a few settings. Or even, worst case scenario, they could have even flown it manually. It has never happened, but that was an option. For re-entry, the same. It was all done by computers. It was only on the last 5 minutes, 10 miles from the runway, when the commander would take manual control to fly into the hack. It's called head aligning cone, in order to align with the runway, and then it flew the final landing, approach and landing. So out of a 10-day mission, basically pilot had something like 5 minutes of manual flight time, and the only reason was that the pilot insisted in having this capability, because otherwise the shuttle could have flown everything. It could have landed on the runway on its own. But they said, well, first and foremost, they are pilots, so they want to fly, obviously. And the second reason is because they said, let's suppose something happens. You know, we are just on final approach, and all of a sudden something goes wrong, and we need to take over manual control. We want to have already that, we want already to have manual control before approaching the runway, so we already know how the spaceship is behaving. We don't want to waste precious seconds in, you know, disengaging the automatic system, engaging the manual system. So that's why they basically took manual control something like 5 minutes before landing. But otherwise, they could have done. The other problem why, the other reason why this was never done in practice is because you should have qualified the system to do so. And the only way to qualify the system was to fly it completely in automatic mode. So you should have had a few missions where you would send the shuttle on its own, and then you would have the shuttle returning automatically. So you had to try it a few times. Now, launching the shuttle just to do that wouldn't be quite expensive, and so that's why it was never done. That's the reason. And on the other end, the astronauts were, the pilots were very good at flying it. They got very good training. So ATN NASA never saw the need to, try this capability for real. But otherwise, in theory, he could have done it. He could have done it.
What about his comment? Give him a comment on the Buran from the Soviet Union.
Yes. So the Buran was fairly similar to the shuttle. There was a little bit of coping, if you want. But you know, also what they say: great artists steal. You know, so the thing is, if you want to design a space plane, there aren't that many ways of doing it. You know, you need to have a fuselage and wings and a tail and engine. So you know, that's why there were similarities. The Buran was slightly bigger than the shuttle. And another difference, important difference, was that the shuttle had carried its own main engines. The three main engines in the back,
right?
They were attached to the. They were part of the space shuttle. Were part of the fuselage. Even though they were only used for 10 minutes, only for the ascent, really, and nothing else. For the rest of the mission, that was dead weight, but it was quite expensive dead weight, because the engines were made to be reusable, so they had to be kept on board. You didn't want to lose them. The Buran instead didn't have his own main engine, so it was his rocket booster that would carry the Buran into space, and Buran had only the capability of maneuvering itself, so changing orbits, like also the space shuttle. So that was a very important difference. It's like if basically the main engines of the space shuttle, rather than being on the orbiter, were on the external tank. So this is what the Russians did with the Buran. The other main difference was that Buran was able to fly on its own. So they added provision to attach, I think it was 4 or 6, I don't remember exactly, jet engines, so that at the end of a mission, the orbiter could fly on its own to another mission, so it could ferry itself to the wherever he had to go. For the space shuttle, instead, this wasn't possible, because every time he landed in California, at Edwards Air Force Base, then he had to be ferried on top of 747.
And, of course, the Buran really never flew, though, did it?
If only once, it was in completely automatic mode, It went nicely, went well, but then unfortunately, the program was very expensive. The Soviets did it because they were afraid that the space shuttle would be used by the Americans for their secret, you know, black ops, like snagging one of their satellites or disabling their own satellite. So they wanted to have something equivalent. And then the Soviet Union fell. So the whole program just went, you know, was just closed down. There is, if since Bijan is in Europe, in Sweden, in Germany, there is in a museum near Frankfurt, there is one of the Buran used for the atmospheric test flights. So it's basically the equivalent of the Enterprise.
So there is one actually being used now?
No, no, but it's in a museum. Because,
okay.
You know, like NASA built the Enterprise to do the atmospheric testing.
Uh-huh.
The Russians did the same thing. They built several of these Burans, which are exactly the same of the Buran that flew in space. They were just not space-worthy machines. And they used them to just test the atmospheric flying qualities of the Buran. And they're all in Russia, but this one that is in Germany is in a museum.
Okay, and David, we're halfway, so we're going to time our break really on time for a change. So, listener, we are going to pause for our break, and you can call us. We do answer the phone during the break. It is 1-866-687-7223. Email remains drspace@thespaceshow.com. And I guess we'll be back in about 3 minutes. So don't go anywhere, anyone.
The Space Show thanks its listeners for their generous support. The Space Show now joins forces with the One Giant Leap Foundation to further advance space education and the establishment of a spacefaring society and culture in America and the world. One Giant Leap Foundation is a tax-exempt organization with the purpose of advancing space education and development along with The Space Show. Your support of The Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation helps get the word out as to why space is so essential and important to us all. So join with us by going to www.thespaceshow.com and clicking on the Support The Space Show button. Your contribution will help The Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation in continuing its work and bringing you the programming you want free of charge on a continued basis. And remember, your gift to The Space Show is tax deductible.
The mission of The Space Show is to promote future economic opportunities, scientific discoveries, and medical advances for all humankind through peaceful and cooperative ventures in outer space. The Space Show intends to be the forum by which space exploration becomes an integral part of our culture, our economy, our country, our world, and our global vision, in which all nations unite in creating a thriving future through the enormous potentials afforded by off-Earth opportunities. The Space Show is committed to advancing integrity and responsibility, both in our off-Earth conduct and in the potential long-range consequences of our actions in space. The Space Show wants to make the dreams of space today the realities of tomorrow.
Welcome back, everybody. Part two of our Space Show program. We have a couple of sponsors that we want to thank for the second part. Orbital ATK, the global leader in aerospace and defense technology, and the partner you can count on for advanced, reliable space propulsion systems for space exploration, commercial ventures, and defense. The American Institute of Aeronautics and Astronautics has 5 annual forums or conferences: SciTech, Defense, Aviation, Propulsion, and Energy, plus Space. And they bring together like-minded aerospace pros across the country, India, industry, academia, and government for a blend of engaging plenary sessions, in-depth 4 and 360 programs, robust tech programming, and networking. So you should check them out. Go to their website, AIAA.org, and you will be very happy you did that. And then Celestis is our sponsor. They are still the only proven provider of Memorial spaceflight services in the world. And they are getting ready to launch from New Zealand. And I just read where Rocket Lab is getting ready to do their Electron test that they've had to delay for a while. And that is the rocket that is going to take the Celestis launch to the moon. So for the first quarter of 2018, the Electron launcher will lift off from New Zealand with a spacecraft bound for the moon. Aboard the Moon Express lunar spacecraft will be cremated remains and DNA samples from the Celestis participants worldwide. This is the second Celestis lunar mission. In 1998. NASA asked Celestis to provide our Memorial spaceflight service to friends of Apollo scientist Eugene Shoemaker so that he could fly aboard Lunar Prospector. So if you want more information and you're interested in maybe sending your DNA or the remains of a loved one to the moon, contact them. Their website, Celestis.com. And, David, now that Space Shuttle is clearly over, there's no chance of going back. There were some ideas at the time to privatize it and to do this, that, and the other. What do you think our space program should be? How should we be getting in space? What should we be doing in space? Are the capsules going to be enough? Or are they only, you know, a short-term solution, maybe good for only a few years? How do you see future space unfolding?
Mm-hmm. Okay. Thanks for the question, because it's actually what I'm working on for another book that I'm writing in this for the next 2 years. And a few times Jeff Bezos has said that he envisions a future where all heavy manufacturing industry is in space rather than being on Earth. And I believe in that vision because we are because the planet is overpopulated, we are depleting very fast our natural resources, we are polluting the environment. Overpopulation is bringing all sorts of social problems. I mean, it's a quite vast topic, but I'm doing a lot of research in this sense. And, you know, when you read all these reports or books that expose the way in which we are damaging our environment in order to support our lifestyle, I mean, it's really depressing. And if you're prone to depression, it's better if you don't read this stuff, because the future doesn't really look very, very happy, to be honest. You know, we in the Western world, we are living well. We are having all sorts of goods. We have a good life. And we have emerging countries like India or China, where you have more than 2 billion people combined together that are aspiring to live in the same way which we are living. And this obviously is driving the demand for manufacturing more and more goods and more stuff. And you do that by using resources. And that's why we are really depleting our resources. And to me, the idea of having, you know, factories in space is a good one, because we have basically all we need on the moon or on the asteroids. Obviously, I don't say that it's something easy to do. It's not something that you can do, you know, in a few years. It will require, it's a huge effort. And that's why, you know, I'm trying to write about it. I'm trying to come up with a plan that it might even last 100 years that might, you know, help us to use space not only as a place to go and explore, but also a place for exploitation. I don't think that space is part of the economy. Obviously, we have economic interest in going to space. The economy benefits from that, but space is not really part of the economy, of the global economy. It should be much more different. I'm not saying that it is a panacea for all the problems on the planet, but I think that Jeff Bezos' vision of having industries in space might be actually helpful for the future. So I personally see a future where we have space stations or spacecraft that are scouting through the solar system, looking for resources, asteroids are probably the easiest target, and where we are learning how to mine for these resources, where we are learning how to exploit the properties of the of space for manufacturing products. In the 70s and 80s, there was a huge work being undertaken by NASA or other aerospace industries where they were planning for this. There were a lot of studies done on how things could be produced in space, how you could use microgravity or the radiation environment or the sharp temperature changes in space in order to produce products. And for whatever reason, all this interest faded away in the 90s and it hasn't come back yet. So I think that the next step for us is to have a cool space program, is to have a space program that is beneficial for humankind on Earth. We were saying before, a lot of people will miss the space shuttle. I will miss the space shuttle, and probably nothing else will be produced as the space shuttle for the time being. But we don't need to have a cool spaceship. We need to have a cool space program. We need to have an iconic space program. We need to have something that is really helpful for people on Earth. You know, oftentimes I talk with people, colleagues, for instance, they know that I'm a space advocate, I like space, and, you know, they always ask, why do we go in space? Why do we waste money to do that? Why we do that? Blah, blah, blah. A lot of people don't really see the value of space. They don't see it. And they're a little bit right, because a lot of stuff is done just for the sake of going into space. It doesn't seem that there is this, that much benefit brought down to Earth. We have a lot of economic problems, social problems, terrorism. So people are concerned with these issues. When they see astronauts going in space, these super trained, clever people that are just, they represent a tiny, tiny fraction of the human population, a lot of people is not really interested in these sort of things. Even the Apollo program, you know, we went on the moon only for beating the Russians, just to see, just to show who was best. There wasn't any reason to bring real benefits to humankind. I perfectly agree that there is spin-off, there are satellite applications that we do use and they are beneficial. But I think that space can do much, much more for us. It's always a very complicated topic, so I'm just trying to be very brief, but I think that is feasible. We have a lot of technology that are being developed or that can be developed in the years to come that can help us to reach that this goal, let's say. And I'm not saying that this will solve all the problems on the planet, but I believe that it might help. It might help because a lot of problems are really due to scarcity, resource depletion. A lot of wars, regional wars or small conflicts that we maybe don't know about, they are really driven by the need of getting resources. Like now, we are talking so much about electric cars. You know, we are going all electric. We need batteries. We need batteries to use these vehicles. And in these batteries, we need to have lithium, for instance, or other rare materials, which are called rare because you don't find them in great quantities on concentrations, actually, on the planet. They're only in few places. And so everybody, like China, the U.S., they're all trying to get to those places in order to, you know, secure those reserves because they're not infinite. You know, they're not everywhere. So I do think that we can use the resources of space for easing some of the problems that we are having now. I don't know, does it make sense? I know it's a very short explanation, but does it make sense?
Yeah, but you have a question about it. So
okay.
Ralph in Boston says, given the kind of vision you just shared with us, where does space settlement fit in, or does it fit in with you?
I think at the moment we need to help easing the problems that we have on Earth. So going to Mars now, I don't think is that important. I know that, you know, like Elon Musk always says we need to be a multiplanetary species because you never know, an asteroid might, you know, impact on Earth and half of the human race is wiped out, or I don't know, nuclear war, you know, again, same outcome. But, you know, it might happen. It might happen. There are a lot of asteroids out there. But I think this is what I came to think. The likelihood of this happening is very low, and people don't perceive it as a threat. You see? So.
Never mind. I forgot to silence my cell phone. I apologize to everyone.
Oh, no, that's okay. If that was a real threat, that people can really see that we are showered by asteroids, then maybe might say, okay, oh, let's try to move to Mars so at least we can have a plan B in case, you know, something bigger comes and destroys most of the human race. So the idea of going to Mars for that reason is good, but I don't think it, at the moment, can grasp the attention and the interest of the general people. I would like to go to Mars, but I don't think that is the right moment for doing it. I think that now we have a lot of problems on this planet. And I believe that we can help. We can provide, as part of the solution, we can help by building up this infrastructure in space where we are exploiting the resources of the solar system. And then once we have done that, we will also have the capability to say, okay, now we are capable of manufacturing in orbit our own spacecraft. You know, like, for instance, Made in Space is trying to do, you know, it's more scale, but that is a good step in that direction. Once we are able to do that, once we have tested all these means for producing whatever we need in space, then we can say, okay, now we can start moving towards Mars, for instance, you know, or we can colonize the moon, colonize Mars. But now, going to Mars, I don't think is the right solution. I think now we should go to the asteroid, for instance. In fact, I was very disappointed when the asteroid return mission was cancelled, because I thought that was a very good, useful mission, because we could have, you know, tested technologies for getting an asteroid, bringing it back closer to us. We could have, you know, experimented with techniques for mining it. We could have experimented with processes for, you know, building something, you know. But it would have already been a step in that direction. I remember a few weeks ago you had an episode with, what's the name, Caravalla, James Caravalla?
Correct,
He said something like this, that they are planning to basically be able to produce microchips in space.
Right.
You know? And he was also talking about the fact that space exploration should actually work towards benefit humans on Earth. And I completely share that vision. So I do believe that we should concentrate in doing that. And then once we reach that capability, which might be 50 years from now, I don't know, then we can also start thinking, okay, let's build, I don't know, colonies in space, like, you know, O'Neill cylinders or bases on Mars. Also, because if you think about it, you know, Mars is lifeless. I mean, it's probably a cool place to visit, but living on Mars is a lifeless planet. So I don't really know why somebody would like to abandon this beautiful planet to live on a planet where there is no life, where there is, you know, nothing familiar to us. I think it's too much at the moment. I think it's too much. I think we really need to exploit space for our own benefit on Earth. And then once we've reached that level, then we can also start thinking, okay, let's move to Mars. Also because hopefully by then people will have understood the benefit of space exploration, of space exploitation.
You have another email. Sarah's in Albuquerque, New Mexico, and she says you have not mentioned returning to the moon and doing things on the moon. Where does that fit in with your vision?
Well, the problem with the moon is that it's a big body. Okay, it's smaller than Mars, smaller than Earth, but it's still a large body. And, you know, landing on the moon does require a lot of fuel for braking. And likewise, to leave the moon requires fuel because you need to overcome the gravitational pull of the moon. So I believe that asteroids might be easier at this point in time to go to. for this simple reason, because it just requires less. No, they call it delta V, you know, which is a parameter that tells you how much fuel you need to reach a certain destination. So I think asteroids, also they're smaller, so you can have, a spacecraft where a big bag is inflated around the asteroid, and then you carry the asteroid back to Earth, and then you can disintegrate the asteroid using concentrated solar power. Actually, there is do you know the NASA NEAC program? Is
right. Yeah, sure.
Actually, there is one group that has proposed a spacecraft like this. It's called APIS. I don't remember what the acronym stands for, but this is what they are proposing, a spacecraft where you have a bag inflated around an asteroid, and then with a system of mirrors, sunlight is concentrated, and you have a beam or light is basically disintegrating the asteroid, and you can extract water, for instance. So I believe the asteroids are a bit easier than the moon. And then also it seems that the moon is a bit more difficult to work on because, the regolith is quite abrasive, so it might be also more difficult to operate machinery on the moon. But, you know, both destinations would be good anyway. I mean, as long as we go somewhere and we start doing something that is working towards the objective of manufacturing products in space, I'm happy. So I need to drink a glass of water.
It does look as if the reality on the ground is that we're going to be focusing on the moon and not on asteroids.
Yeah.
So that seems to be the way of the future, yeah. At least for the short term.
Yeah. The thing is, this return to the moon, that probably will change with the next administration, obviously. what is for? Is it just there to do geological research? I mean, it's interesting. It's absolutely interesting. There's no doubt about it. But I think that space exploration can do much more. Space shouldn't be only there for being explored, but also for being used. If we keep saying, let's go and explore space, people will never accept space as part of their reality because they will always complain. They will always say, listen, but I don't have a job. How can I be on the moon and knowing more about its geology help me to find a new job, you know?
Correct. But I do know, and I talk to a lot of companies and people that are absolutely focused on settlement on the moon.
Mm-hmm.
Space settlement has its own advocacy and followers. It's a very popular thing, and it does inspire a lot of people, even in orbit, orbital settlement, as well as the moon and Mars. I mean, people have given talks and say the only reason to do human spaceflight is space settlement.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
There's no other reason.
Yeah,
for it. You've probably heard the talks. So I think in terms of advocacy popularity, probably space manufacturing is probably down the list, although, you know, the commercial entrepreneurial space really wants to see an economy develop in space.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Would obviously include manufacturing.
Mm-hmm. I mean, the very first book I read in English when I learned the language was The High Frontier of Gerard O'Neill.
Oh, right.
So I love the idea of building space settlements in space. The problem is, as you said, these ideas are brought forward by space advocates. So they're already brought forward by people that are interested in the subject. That's easy. But to convince the layman, the man on the street that has lost his job or that has been victim of terrorism, that it's important to go into space because, I don't know, it's human destiny to go into space. To be honest, I don't think it's a sufficient reason to do it. I think in the space advocate community, it's easy to discuss these topics because we are all interested, we are all passionate about it. We all want to go in space, so it's easy. But we are a small part of the community, and I think if you want to reach the heart of everybody else, we need to be a little bit more pragmatic and practical in our approach to space.
This one's interesting. Dawn, D-A-W-N, mm-hmm. is in New York. And Don says, what would be your idea of space development that benefits people on Earth? I mean, what are you actually talking about? Mm-hmm. What kind of businesses or what kind of projects are you talking about? And are you considering that they would be done by private business people or government?
It will definitely be a public-private partnership, at least at the beginning, and then probably it will evolve in something that is managed by private organizations. My idea is to do the following. We start developing technologies and programs aimed at, for instance, go to asteroids, mine them. So we want to demonstrate the capability. We want to demonstrate that we can do it, that it's possible to do. We want to do demo flights to, at least in small scale, demonstrate that we can build, for instance, a complex object like a microchip or a spacecraft. In the meantime, I think the space advocacy community should really engage into educating people on how a lot of our issues that we have at the moment are due because we are demanding too much out of our planet. We are depleting our resources. There's a huge body of literature, both popular science or, you know, proper scientific papers, reports, that do show that we are reaching tipping points, that we are reaching peak production of many elements on the planet. So we need to start educating people towards this problem. And the fact that it's this lack of resources that will bring us to more wars in the future and to damage to the environment, water, soil, air, and everything else. And I think that we should, especially the space community, should lobby our government into pushing space agencies towards exploiting the solar system. Basically, you know, if our governments understand that we have an issue with resources, and if we want to avoid to nuke each other in the future, we need to find alternative sources for these resources. Why not start to explore the possibility of gathering these or collecting these resources on space? So if at least we start putting money into projects like this, we can demonstrate the feasibility of doing it. And then maybe government might subsidize companies and say, listen, if you produce your stuff in space, then you can pay less taxes, for instance. This also will require a reusable and reliable way to get into space. But now we have SpaceX, for instance, and Blue Origin, that are going to develop large launchers, which will be reusable, and that will bring the cost of going to space very down, very, very low. So we will have the capability of preparing hardware into space, prepare hardware on the ground, for instance, to probes to go on the asteroids, and then we can send a lot of them because flying these rockets is now becoming cheap, and actually they're also capable of carrying a lot of payload. So we can produce a large range of probes. We can have several spacecraft. We can dispatch them in different places to meet different asteroids. We can have the spacecraft capable of performing some sort of mining task or production task. And then it's my hope that in this way, what we can get is at least the capability of having a self-sufficient space infrastructure. Because it would be very nice if we can have the capability of building our own spacecraft, probes, satellites in space. So we don't need to struggle. Because, like, you know, every time NASA decided for a big mission, I don't know, a mission to go to explore the Enceladus, Saturn's moon. In reality, there are a lot of proposals. There are many other proposals behind that one that is picked by NASA or the European Space Agency. So it would be nice if we could have this capability where in space we are able to produce all the satellite probes, scientific probes that we need to do all sorts of scientific investigations that, you know, are being proposed. Because in this way we are doing it directly in space and not on the ground. We don't really need to require funding. And if we are able to have a self-sustainable space infrastructure, then we also have demonstrated that we have the capability of manufacturing goods into space. And I believe that if we are able to demonstrate that, then we can also say, listen, to governments or to private companies, say, listen, it's now possible to build stuff into space. Why don't you start producing some or your product also into space? I know it's a little bit simplistic, this view, but it's very difficult to define exactly how it is going to be. But if we start to at least prove the concept, then I think we will have a strong evidence that it can be done, and then it's, it will be advantageous to do so. Let's say, I don't know, if in the future we are all going electric and we are looking for lithium because we are producing so many batteries on smartphones or cars, aircraft, electric aircraft, and we need lithium and we know that we can extract it easily from asteroids, then maybe we can say, well, let's engage into exploitation of asteroids for lithium, and then we can bring the lithium down to Earth so it can be used to manufacture batteries, or we can make the batteries directly into space and then we can bring them back.
Of course, when you bring
this sort of thing, I have in mind.
When you bring stuff back, you have doubled the transportation costs. You know that.
So,
I mean, you're already distorting the economics by, you know, having doubled the transportation cost to get something back, and so I don't know how low in cost space transportation is reasonably going to go. I mean, it's hard to know if we'll ever achieve the really cheap transportation costs that people talk about. But assuming you don't do that, you know, the transportation costs would probably kill almost every economic product if you want to bring it back to Earth.
Yeah, I mean, I haven't done any economic analysis. All I'm trying to do in this work I'm doing now is to propose, let's call it probably a manifesto, just to show what else we can do into space. And the thing is, I don't believe the future will be very positive. And we do need to find alternative ideas on how we can resolve some of the issues that we are having at the moment. And, you know, if you think about it, we will also need to change other things, like, I don't know, our way of living. You know, we don't really need to buy a smartphone every 6 months or change car every 5 years. You know, probably we will also need to change our approach to the way in which we live, change a little bit the capitalistic system. But it's a big argument, but I do believe that there is potential in this sense that space can offer. And it should be investigated. It should be investigated. We shouldn't only stop saying, let's go to Mars, because it's human destiny to go to explore, you know, the frontier. It's true, but I think we can give a more practical and reasonable approach to space exploration than what we are currently doing.
In the few minutes we have left, in the conclusion of your book, you seem to answer the question of whether the shuttle was actually a failed project or a successful one.
Mm-hmm.
You thought it was a successful one. Why do you think the shuttle, with all of its problems and limitations and the fatal accidents, why was it a successful project?
Let's compare it with Apollo. Apollo went to the moon. The Apollo program went to the moon. That's it. It was only aimed on going to the moon. And every mission was basically the same. After Apollo 11, I mean. They landed in different places, but basically those missions were following the same layout, you know, going to Earth orbit, reaching lunar orbit, undocking the lunar module, landing, doing your exploration, and then coming back, reconnected with the common module, and then coming back to Earth. This space shuttle did many more things. And actually, in the book, what I did was to show how all these space shuttle missions could be basically divided into three large categories. One is the shuttle as a launch platform. So in the first years before the Challenger disaster, NASA launched a lot of commercial satellites and developed upper stages to do that. Then the space shuttle was used extensively as a workshop for servicing satellites. The Hubble telescope is obviously the most important example. It was used for building the space station. And then the shuttle was also used as scientific laboratory. You know, in the absence of a space station, the space lab missions and the space hub flights basically gave NASA the opportunity of carrying out scientific research, even for just 2 weeks, but at least there was that aspect. And you don't see any of this in the Apollo program. It's just the variety of missions undertaken by the shuttle that is incredible. Besides, the shuttle program flew 135 times. So it is a huge number of flights, and each flight was different. Each flight had to be custom made, had to be planned. It flew, normally each mission had 5 or 6 astronauts, so a larger crew compared to the 3 astronauts on the Apollo capsule. And you had to train all those people. NASA had to learn to manage a fleet of reusable spacecraft. It's like if it was a small airline, you know. So they had to do that. They had to learn to organize payloads. They had to learn to talk with payload manufacturers in order to, you know, have the right interfaces between the payload and the space shuttle. They had to, you know, all the spacewalking activity undertaken for rescuing satellites, for building the space station, it just gave such a huge experience in the field of working and living in space that no other program has done it before. And, okay, living in space, space stations obviously is what offers the most in this sense, but this space shuttle just carried such a large variety of things that really no other space program has done so far. And this is why I think it wasn't a failure. Granted, the shuttle had problems, but we know why. It was the final configuration was more of a political compromise than engineering compromise. Funding was scarce, so NASA had to adapt, and they didn't create an extremely safe spacecraft. We know that there were several Achilles heels, but in the years, through the years, the system really grew, and it was really able to undertake a larger variety of tasks. They even, you know, even allowed like women to fly in space before. Well, there was Valentina Tereshkova in space, but it was mostly as a PR thing. So we had women flying space, we had minorities flying space, we also had opening towards international collaboration with, for example, the Space Lab flights. So I think that just seeing what has been accomplished in 30 years makes the shuttle a successful program. And then obviously you just need to keep in mind why it was created that way, and you know, there wasn't really much to do. I think based on what they got, despite it was a flawed machine, they really did the best they could with it.
Listeners, his book again, and I really recommend it, The Space Shuttle Program, Technologies and Accomplishments, is published by Springer Praxis. You'll appreciate it. It has a lot of good, solid information in it. I think everybody should be this familiar with the space show, and it'll help you understand things going forward. When do you think your next book is going to be out?
2020.
Yeah. So we've got
two years. It's a complex subject, and I'm still developing.
Okay.
As I'm doing research, you know, it happens quite often that you start with an idea and then, or with a certain layout for your book, and then you realize as you go forward that maybe certain things need to be changed. So I really need 2 good solid years in order to complete it and to develop more my plan, let's say.
Well,
and just give a different view to space exploration.
Well, remember us here. We'll still be around. So let us know when you are ready to talk about it more, or if you want to bounce some theories or ideas off and gauge it as to see what some people might think about what you're saying. Give us a try, and we'll let you throw ideas out there and see what it's like. Okay?
Okay. Oh, definitely. Absolutely. I would love that.
Okay. It's
Thanks.
Great talking to you again. A very happy new year, although it's not all that new anymore going forward. And we will stay in touch, and I'll get the archives off to you, if not later today, very early in the morning. And keep up your good work. Thank you very much.
Thanks to you, David. Thanks to your listeners for the good questions. I really enjoy the conversation.
Okay,
thanks.
And listeners, we do have a Sunday program, and so stay tuned, and we'll be here for Sunday. And we do have programming next week, although, as you know, it's my moving week, so we'll probably, I think we go through Friday, and then Sunday is when we are not doing programs for a week. But anyway, thanks to David for being with us today, and for those of you who sent in email questions. Everyone have a great week coming up, and thanks for listening to The Space Show. Goodbye from David, and goodbye from David, and all of you too. Bye, everyone. Keep looking up.